Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. For years, former Tulsan Carol Harrelson has made the books of artists, photographers, chefs, and museums look beautiful. A 10-time winner of the Oklahoma Book Award for Design and a 10-time winner of the American Association of Museums Award for Excellence in Design, Harrelson is a highly sought-after book designer. For years, she edited and designed Gilcrease's Quarterly Journal and the National Park Sojourns periodical, as well as over 200 book projects. But she's also been a printmaker and won Nimrod's Pablo Neruda Award for Poetry before focusing her professional life around editing and design. Now she's published her own book, an interesting mix of memoir, essay, short fiction, poetry, design, illustration, and photography, as well as a recipe of her grandmother's custard. In short, a collection as eclectic and wide-ranging as the author. Titled At the Far End of O Street, a nod to her hometown of Miami, Oklahoma, it's a beautiful book that depicts her life in more than mere words. She'll be talking about her book and signing it Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books. Carol Harrelson is our guest today. Carol Harrelson, it is such a pleasure to have you, and it's way too long having you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Now, you have worked on countless books by others, making them look beautiful and over the years. So why did you decide finally to write your own book?
I've been always writing books. I've been scribbling in on magnolia leaves. I've been tying together with grapevine when I was little pieces of paper and scratching. At one point I designed a book on the garage door with my mother's lipstick. So I kind of started young, but I never could really separate image from language and the word from the picture. And I kind of think, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately, that sort of maybe we all do that. Like you're thinking, when I leave here tonight, I need a quart of milk. So you think, I need, and then you see a little picture of the Safeway, and then you see a little picture of a quart of milk. I think we're bouncing around all the time between picture and language. I always wanted to make a book. For decades, I wanted to make a book.
Well, you made a lot of books for other people.
I wanted to make a book for me. I wanted to make a book because it's like putting preserves in a jar, which I also do every year from our fruit trees. I'm big about capturing time in something transparent. And I wanted to do that with a book that had in it the things that have seemed most clear and right for me, most close to the heart, that I thought maybe somebody else would like also to hear. And because paper lasts longer than flesh, I've born in the last century. So in this century, I thought, dang, I want to put something on a table that will still be there when I don't walk around in my body anymore.
Mm. You've always been a writer.
Always a writer.
I know you used to do poetry and still probably do poetry, but you were active as a poet for a while before
right.
the book designing business
yeah,
probably
right. Not so
sort
much
of
now.
Took over your life.
My poems in some ways developed wings that were front and back covers. And then we stuffed a lot of pretty stuff in between, and I did as well as I could to mentor the chef or the agate collector or the academic who was looking at Mesoamerican pottery to... I tried to get a really straight shot from their brain into the book, and it had to come through language and image, and every time it was just a hoot.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful.
It's in many ways, it's like doing a far more in-depth interview of getting to know someone, but in this case, you're really trying to transfer their passion
right.
about a subject,
right.
which may be somewhat esoteric.
Right.
It may be niche, you know, a niche interest, mm-hmm. and try to mm-hmm. translate that passion to the greatest number of people through
exactly.
the design. And I think that's really what you've done, because I've seen so many books. We were chatting beforehand. I said, I've seen so many of your books in which I thought the design was as interesting as perhaps the inside of the book.
I mean, that makes me crazy happy. Thank you.
You know, I mean, because really, you turn a lot of the books that you've worked in into sort of art in a way. As a way of presenting it. And you tell very briefly in this book how you became a book designer. Sounds like it was very much a fortuitous accident. Mm-hmm. Tell me that story.
Oh, I was a lithography major at TU as a freshman, and also in love with language and with writing and all of those things together. And there's not really a door marked in for you to walk through if you would like to be a book designer. And in many ways, the book designer is the invisible person in the process of bringing a book into the world. In an ad agency, for example, or a record cover, or there are a lot of places where where the name of the designer is part of the whole process. But when you're making a book for someone, you do it as quietly as possible. And it's nice if somebody notices that someone did it. But if you do it right, people think no one did it. They think it just was born like a mushroom.
Yeah. And I assume there are some certain books, and this wouldn't be necessarily the projects you would work on, where it is very cut and dried. It's about, mm-hmm. Presenting the book, finding a good cover, mm-hmm. finding an attractive cover that's going to urge people to pick it up. Mm-hmm. But you're doing something very different. It's usually a subject that involves a lot of illustrations, photographs, mm-hmm. something that has to sort of accompany the text and tell a story of mm-hmm. its own.
Yeah, exactly. So that on my goal, especially with photography books, is that every spread, when you turn a spread, it's like turning a pair of wings. When you turn a spread, everything alive there in language should be dancing around with everything alive there in image and, maybe slow dancing.
Well, now back to this fortuitous accident. I guess you went out to Gilcrease, is that right? Or a museum here?
Philbrook. I went to Philbrook thinking that I would maybe they would be crazy enough to hire me to teach lithography to children.
Uh-huh.
Because I was sort of looking for the next thing I was going to do. And they had a new director, a really interesting guy. He'd just come from New York, and he wanted to kind of shake it up. Mm-hmm. And one of the things he wanted to do was to bring the whole publication effort in-house. It had always been farmed out to really excellent ad agencies, but he wanted it under the roof there. And somehow in our conversation, we wandered into that office he was imagining where the publications might originate from in this future he was imagining. And he kind of turned and looked at me and he said, "You interested in that?" And I said, I'm like, "Are you kidding?" So he hired me. And so I went on a little self-sabbatical quickly. I asked all the people I knew who were working in ad agencies doing publication or posters or marketing things,
right,
if I could just come and stand behind them for a day and maybe ask a few dumb questions if I weren't in the way. They generously allowed me to. And so
this was a crash course.
Yeah. So I kind of knew how printmaking, I knew how ink on paper worked. I knew how language worked. I didn't know the production part yet. So I studied and studied quickly and just walked in and started doing it. And it was so much fun that it was easy to be there 10 hours a day. And we were just doing brochures at that time. By the time I left, we were doing full-scale, internationally circulated art exhibition catalogs, mm-hmm. and other books.
Yeah. And I assume along the way you ran into Paulette Millichap, but who
yes.
was at Cancel Oak?
Oh, Paulette. We were in a writing group together. I adored Paulette from the moment I saw her. And this was a really great writer's group. To everybody in there was so alive and so much fun. And she and Michael Hightower and Sally Dennison, Sally was also in the writer's group, had this, it probably sprouted out of the top of Paulette's head, lots does.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, she took on some partners, and they just started a publishing house.
In Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Right, Council Oak.
Which was, at that time kind of...
Counterintuitive.
Very, that's very generous, yes.
And they named it after that big tree that people got around to try to understand one another. And but they didn't know... They're terrific people. They knew a lot. They didn't know how you got the ideas for a book onto paper inside covers.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to come aboard. The first book we did was Cleora's Kitchens.
Yeah.
And basically, I was now teaching what I'd learned over more than 10 years at Philbrook about making the physical body of a book. They were channeling a lot of beautiful material to inform and inhabit the book. And so we had this terrific collaboration. I also got to edit some of the books there because I do love editing. I am a like crazy born editor too, but I love that. And so they let me do that occasionally. Sally was doing that. She was really good at it. Paulette was just was shining up the world so it would reflect us. And it was a great time.
And that's,
and I learned so much.
Yeah. And all of a sudden you're doing book design for publishers and everywhere, all over the world now. Yeah. And have been. This book, which is titled At the Far End of O Street, is a very interesting book because it's a bit of memoir. It's a bit of essays. It's a bit of poetry. There's even a few recipes. What was the thinking behind this book?
I wanted to put a nice big fluffy bun of essays and short fiction on top of a little rich filling of poetry with a bottom. What did they call the bottom of a sandwich?
Crust.
The bottom crust. I kind of wanted a crunchy, chewy, crispy, gooey box of confections in this book, but I wasn't going to scare anybody with the poetry. I was going to put it between the crusts.
It's like the middle of an Oreo, right?
Yeah. Some people just, you know, twist them and lick it, but some people, they have to have, it has to be hidden. So,
well, as you said, you've been writing your whole life, mm-hmm. and so I assume these are essays collected over time that you've been doing,
mm-hmm.
And you wanted to tell some personal story.
I did.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What was the stories you wanted to tell about your
life? One of the very important stories I wanted to tell, and it's been a through thread in my life down my maternal line. I was very close to my mother, who I think she walked 6 inches off the ground all her life. But she was the daughter, the granddaughter of a woman born in India during the Raj. She was Burmese Indian, Anglo-Burmese mm-hmm. Baby, who was brought by her English father, I think biological father, to his friend, the Archbishop of the Cathedral in Rangoon, India, to be brought up by the nuns there in the convent school. The story was always unclear about who her mother was. All I can say was, whoever her mother was, she became the bride of an Englishman. He moved her to Calcutta, and where he was a teak merchant, and she lived with him there, and had her first son there, my great uncle John, who only spoke Hindustani as a babbling baby, apparently.
Wow.
And they lived with the elephants that rolled the teak logs. The elephants at the end of the day would go off and splash around in a pond. And when I lost my grandmother and then my mother, a trove of things I maybe hadn't been looked at in quite a while, came into my keeping as an accidental curator for my family. And among them were Bon Ma's, what we called her, were Bon Ma's school books from the convent. Incredible penmanship and beautiful writing. She was a font designer in 1877 before we had, no, she was born to, 150 years later, she would have been a great font designer because that's what she was doing with all her penmanship.
What insight did that give you, seeing her? I mean, I know she wasn't a font designer, but it was like, here was somebody who was experimenting
There's a picture of it in the book.
Yeah. Well, how did that strike you as somebody who's spent so many years trying to make pages look beautiful?
I'm a nutcake over fonts. Yeah. I'm a nutcake about fonts. But I didn't. It took me a long time. I've had care of her notebooks for a long time before. It was kind of after this book was in print that I looked at that page where I took with my handy-dandy little iPhone some pictures of those notebooks to illustrate the story about her, and saw that she was a font designer before there was such a thing. And so I was thrilled.
And yet she had this amazing life. She ended up in America, right?
She did. She, with the boy John, who was still not speaking English, and her husband, got on a sailboat and went to San Francisco and then got on a train and went to Lookout Mountain, Tennessee. Because he was kind of like a Steve Jobsy sort of person. He was like, okay, now teak is a thing. Okay, now lead and zinc is a thing. And now he went to a place that was kind of a hotbed for new businesses and startups and all that. And she had other children, among them my grandmother. And then one summer, he brought her down to Joplin, Missouri, so that he could go out by train to look at places where lead and zinc was being found. And
we know where this is, yes.
Yes.
Northeastern Oklahoma.
Exactly.
What would be northeastern,
yes,
Oklahoma.
Yes, that little corner, Joplin, Missouri. And they were just there for the summer. And he was out looking at a mining site, came back by train, and was shot by someone who had been thrown off the train by the conductor for being too drunk and rowdy. And they didn't know what else to do with him, so they took the door off the men's room. My great-grandmother remembered it as a flaking green door and put him on it as a gurney, and brought him back to Bon Ma and her five children in the rented house in Joplin, dead.
Yeah.
And so she had to make a whole nother life for everyone. Or those children made lives for themselves and took care of her. And the guy that her husband was in business with, the house burned down on Lookout Mountain, and then he embezzled the rest of the money. And so she was a...
Really?
So that's a story I wanted to tell, because it's a story of tribalism and aggression that's in the blood, but also love that comes down to us in the blood. And because I was raised in Miami, Oklahoma, around a lot of tribal groups who also were disenfranchised. And sometimes people thought I was Indian, because I used to be darker when I was little. And I would say, I said once to the chief of the Miami tribe, I said, yes, I am Indian, part Indian, but my people were subjugated on a different continent. And then he looked at me. I thought for a moment, I was trying to make him laugh, actually.
Right.
Sometimes I don't do that right. And I looked at his face and I realized, oh, I'll never have that thought or say that again, because it was nothing the same. You know, the white guys never left here, for one thing.
Yeah.
And the English eventually left India. But the whole thing made me think about how we're all mixed. We all come down. We are this borderless mixture of courage and love and shared talents. And I wanted to tell that by talking about my great-great-grandmother.
Yeah. My guest today is Carol Harrelson, a wonderful editor, book designer, and writer. And she has a new collection out titled At the Far End of O Street. And she's our guest today on Studio Tulsa, and it is a beautiful book, as you would expect, that Carol Harrelson designed, but it's also her words as well. And there's, again, a mixture of memoir. There are essays. Some are what's appeared to be some fiction. There's short fiction in there. And poetry, which I never knew you were a poet. And then I look at I'm looking at some of the back, and I go, this poem is reprinted courtesy of Nimrod, which won the Pablo Neruda Prize several years ago. And you actually are open to one of those poems. So poetry has always been a big part of your life, too.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Are you still active writing poetry?
Mm-hmm.
Or is that something that was it just a thing you did at one point?
I have a notebook in every room of the house, and I scratch in all of them kind of all the time. And sometimes it's just a word. That, like the word metaphor, for example, I've been thinking about lately, that I would like to be a discoverer, an explorer who can somehow drag myself up the mountain of that word back and back into its history and figure out what the heck it really meant. And it goes way back. So sometimes it's just a word I'm scribbling or a phrase from the New York Times or something. And then I will let it sprout for a while and then go back to it and scratch some things around it. And I'm always writing.
Yeah. Well, why don't you read us a poem, won't you? And when did you write this one? This How to Grow Roses.
This one goes back a ways from when I was at TU.
Really?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. how to grow roses. Feed the rose rice water in a spadeful of earth. Watch for buds. Each bud is the egg of a rose. When the buds break, a flock of roses will fly up. Each rose holds a lens of water. Each lens reflects as a green yawn the long, trembling corridor of stem the rose has traveled. A rose is made with no retracting spring and can only loosen. This is the life and death of roses. You will see it in the tracing of a seashell rose made in a dark room by thrusting a shaft of light to the belly of the bud. Here is the ruby flare of the young rose, and there the bare whiskered heart of the old one. Some say the rose is frivolous. Heads of state do not mention roses in their diaries. Yet the faces in their dreams are circles of climbing blaze. The hands that reach for them are foliate and spined. Bending near one who sleeps without fear, you will hear a sound like ostrich fans beaten on silk or the swift applause of moths. This is the sound of roses. Lovers of roses have on their bare arms the tattoo of roses' teeth. Lovers of roses believe a Y branch of saint's gold will seek water. Lovers of roses infuse knobs of tea rose to cure grief, first cutting the bloom gently from the hip. Brokers of roses French cut stems so they may point to earth, the home of roses. Some blend roses old with new. Magicians draw them from the sleeve of air. If you wish to grow roses, you must be patient.
It's very nice. Thank you. That's the poetry of my guest today, Carol Harrelson, editor, book designer, and writer. Her new book is titled At the Far End of O Street. It was very interesting as I was reading some of the essays, which I thought were essays, and then I realized, no, this is fiction.
Some.
Yeah. Fiction. And the whole thing is...
I'm looking for the seam. I don't know where it is.
Well, and you know, the thing is I've read an essay previous that was obviously an essay, a nonfiction essay, and then I read the next one, and I'm thinking... Oh, this is more nonfiction. And then at some point I realize, no, she would. And then all of a sudden a narrator, you know, the narrator becomes another character in the story. And why distort all these genres together in the way you did? What was the reasoning, the thought behind it?
There's nothing I can break apart except an orange. I am actually love the way things want to hug each other and waltz. You know, I started to say bleed into each other, but that's kind of macabre. But yes, the fiction that's in this book that I would say is actual fiction. It has characters I made up. Mm-hmm. They're doing things that I caused them to do. Things happen to them in the end that were not God's work. And those little pieces are actual fiction, but there are many things in that little piece of fiction that are things I love and know in life. And it's real hard to separate that one from the other. And then sometimes I start an essay that is a record of a moment in time, and I find myself exaggerating or embroidering just enough that it isn't really memoir anymore.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense. And I know in the one I was thinking of, it's one of the longer pieces. It's called Apostrophe, and it's about a woman in a writing group,
right,
that has found a new boyfriend who, uh-huh, is obsessed with the apostrophe. And you know, that's sort of interesting, you know, a writer's group, uh-huh, you know, but then all of a sudden it just takes you through twists and turns. And I think it's preceded by a piece that is not fiction at all. Isn't that the case? The Flash.
No, that's not fiction. And the imagery, too, is sometimes I composed it by bringing things I love in my office that seem to speak to the language in this book, and making a physical montage and shooting it from above. Like, for example, on the cover of the book, mm-hmm, the front cover, that medallion in the middle that looks kind of shiny.
Mm-hmm.
That is a glass of champagne that I was drinking when I was picking apricots with a friend of mine who always has a big apricot party once a year. She's got a great tree. And then she brings out champagne and we pick apricots. And I'm looking down at it and I said, Divya, wow, will you hold that while I take a picture of it? And so this is a glass of champagne that I was drinking. And the metallic circle around it is the top of an old lamp I have in my office studio mm-hmm. that I also shot from above so that it can have something to embrace it.
It looks like an eye.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. Right. Or a porthole to another world.
Yeah.
And
I think that's the best description of it. This book, it's sort of a porthole into the world of Carol Harrelson. Don't you think?
Well, I suppose it is. Yeah, I wasn't trying to. It was fun to do because I right until the very end I didn't really believe I was going to have more than one copy of it. And then at the very last moment, I'm like, flash, it's going to be December. I would like to have these for Christmas presents. So I got it together and got it to the printer. And the first person that got one was the fellow that drove the truck that brought the 1,000 copies of it to our storage unit. And he was so dear and helped me get it into a place where it could live until it went to new homes. And so I rushed out and handed him a copy of it. He looked at it and he said, that's your name, because I had just signed my name to say that yes, I'd received the books. And he said, "Wait, that's your name," and looked at his piece of paper again as if maybe I was teasing him. And I said, "I hope your daughter reads poetry. Or maybe you do." Yeah. So, and from then on, it's just been one kind of fun after another.
Well, it is a beautiful book, as a Carol Harrelson book will be. And it's also wonderful laugh aloud essays in this. There
Thank
are
you.
Very provocative, very thought-provoking essays, some Thank beautiful you. Poetry, and there's even a recipe or two to try.
There's a at the recipe.
The name of the book is At the Far End of O Street. Carol, thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, Rich, what a joy. Thank you.
Carol Harrelson is an editor, book designer, and writer of poetry and prose. After years of doing other authors' book projects, she's doing her own. It's titled At the Far End of O Street. It's published by El Otro Lado. She'll be signing the book Wednesday evening at 7 o'clock at Magic City Books. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.
The University of Tulsa welcomes the Greater Tulsa community to a wide array of athletic events, artistic performances, exhibitions, academic lectures, and symposia held on campus. Our public events are open to all. Requests for accommodation of disabilities may be directed to Dr. Tawny Rigsby at 918-631-2315. To ensure availability of an interpreter, 5 to 7 days' notice is needed. 48 hours is recommended for all other accommodations.